Sloppy Spoilers with your host, DT2. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Sloppy Spoilers. I'm your host, David Taylor 2. You know me as DT2 Comics Chat on Twitter. Tonight we're going to be discussing the season finale of The Boys, season 2, episode 8, entitled colloquially, I believe it's What I Know. And we're also going to be discussing season 2, episode 8 of The Umbrella Academy, which is The Seven Stages. I'd like to welcome my co-host. Welcome to David Nemesis Howard. What's up, Dave?
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Glad to be here. You can find me on Twitter at NemesisFC2, and really looking forward to talking about these two shows.
I'd like to welcome Steve Shadewing Sellers. What's up, Steve?
Doing great. Glad to be back after missing last week, and I'm really looking forward to this. I would certainly not miss this finale of The Boys, and you can find me on Shadewing at Twitter.
And welcome to Jeff, Dr. Fate Bracey.
Oh, man, I have got to stop by the Academy and get me an umbrella, because boy, oh, boys, is it raining blood. I had to go there. Yes, you can find me at Bracey452 on Twitter. That's at Bracey452.
Awesome, awesome. Okay, we're going to do things a little bit differently. Tonight, we're going to start with The Boys. So much to say, and we're going to start with the end and work backwards.
How misogynistic of you, starting with The Boys there.
Memento style.
Oh, that means everybody will forget it by the time we're done. Okay, so we're going to start at the end and work backwards. So first thing I want to talk about is Congresswoman Newman. She turns out to be the telepathic, scanners style head popper,
Dr. Pimple
head burster. That's right, right to the extreme. That's right, Congresswoman Newman. And so we finally get a shot of her, and her eyes are misting over, and we see that she's been the one popping all these heads. And she was definitely there last week when we had the boys' version of the Red Wedding. And so that was kind of a reveal we've been waiting on. But I want to know what you guys felt about it. What I'll throw out is Alistair, the leader of the Church of the Collective Fresca Crackheads, is talking on the phone with her, and he goes bye-bye. And I was a little bit surprised by that, because I thought they were going somewhere with this arc, but I'm kind of glad they're kind of done with that, because it really felt like all season long, the Church of Collective felt like, you know, what is this still doing in the mix? But when we find out it's her, I really didn't know how to feel, because it's the last thing we see, and then we have to wait till the next season. But we need kind of a retrospective of all the people she's popped, going all the way back to the detective. Because what is her goal? Is she on her way? Is she going to go for the presidency? Is she going to set herself up to make people hate Supes, and she's the only one that can save them? Which is a little bit different from what Stormfront was doing. Is she going to stay undercover? So maybe they did that on purpose to whet our appetites to see where it goes. But I didn't really quite know how to feel. I was glad to find out that we didn't have to wait who it was. But I could have sworn it was the girl at the Sage Grove who had the same power, because the last time we saw her, she was thumbing a ride.
I think her name is Jenny.
Huh?
I'm sorry. I think her name is Jenny.
Right, right. And we didn't see her anymore. So I just had a lot of mixed feelings. I was like, oh, okay. So I want to hear what you guys thought, because I definitely wanted some more information. Start with Nemesis.
I think that this was redemptive for me for the whole season. I think they wasted a hell of a lot of time on this, church, the Church of the Collective stuff. And it didn't go anywhere, and it's kind of sad that, at least, I don't know, maybe it'll come back. Maybe it'll still be around and somebody else will take it over. But having the senator do this, to me, first of all, you know, they've kind of been taking shots this whole season. Last season was Christianity, and then this season was, Scientology, and then and you know, Department of Homeland Security and right wing politics and all that stuff. But then they came back to now this congressman who's clearly a left wing, you know, or on the left figure. Now she's a villain. So, you know, they're playing it even. And I really enjoyed that, you know, for just a non-comic standpoint. But this idea that she's in government and doing this as well, it's really interesting. In fact, it's one of the most interesting things I've seen on The Boys in the two seasons. And I'm really looking forward to it because I'm sitting here thinking, is she a Manchurian candidate? Is she a Black Widow type character from, you know, the Ultimates, who is, you know, infiltrating government in order to take it down from the inside? You know, there's all sorts of ways that could go with it, and I'm really interested. And the fact that she has, like you said, looking back at the people that she has killed, what is the purpose of that? What is her end goal? And then, you know, since we're starting backwards, the fact that now that, of course, Huey is working in her office, you know, it's like, good Lord, you know, this guy does, even when he thinks he's making good decisions, makes bad decisions. So it's like, which is exciting because I'm like, well, now I want to see how bad Huey screwed up, you know, for season three. So, you know, to sum up my feelings about it, this was a great way to end this season because it has me on board for season three already.
That's very interesting. And just to speak to what you said about Huey, his character seems to me to have had the least amount of growth. It's not that he didn't have any, but he had the least amount. So if I'm going to watch one more season of this perpetual Charlie Brown dude,
yeah.
I want to see him do something new. You know what I mean? I want to see him whine again and, oh my God, I'm so terrible. And Starlight, please love me, and I can't believe you like Alma George and Charleston Chews. And okay, we did all that.
But and this was the ultimate Charlie Brown move because he thinks he's growing. He thinks he's stepping forward in his life and doing something new and stepping away from this whole life. And the fact is by moving forward, he just stepped right into the middle of the next mess. You know, so like, oh man, but I want to see it. So.
So at least it did its job. Okay, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I'm really intrigued by where they're going with this, and I think a lot of my thoughts were echo Nemesis on this, but I'll try to add a few things. I kind of got the feeling that they were trying to set up Newland to be kind of like this Tulsi Gabbard figure, this sort of, you know, oh, I'm the reasonable acting congresswoman, but always absolutely. With The Boys, there is the shoe that is waiting to drop because everyone is bad. Every single person is bad. What is her angle? And then we find out that basically she's a scanner. I mean, for all intents and purposes. And I have no doubt that she is killing people to get people out of her way politically so that she can advance herself in some way. The question is, why is she doing it? Is she a well-intentioned extremist, which is certainly a possibility? Like, you know, she really believes what she says she believes. It's just that she's willing to kill to do it. Is it a case where, you know, she's really has malevolent goals and is going to have to be put down? I really see Huey in an interesting position because as much as he's the butt monkey, he's also basically the guy who is in a position to actually do something about the situation once the crap hits the fan and becomes obvious that she's a monster. So, you know, he's probably going to have to spy on her. He's probably going to have to. So that gives him something to do because I have no doubt that Butcher is going to force him to spy on her. And it kind of gives her an interesting conflict between the, you know, the new life that he's trying to choose for himself and the one that he's walking away from, but yet still has some attachment to because he does care to a certain extent about Butcher and these people that he's gotten to know. So I think all that's interesting. Involving the cult of the collective, I'm just glad it's over, honestly. That was just such a nothing plot, and the only purpose that they serve is to get A-Train back on the 7. Which, okay, it's nice to see that. I figure, okay, something was going to have to happen one way or another. And I will point out the other Charlie Brown, which is the Deep. And so we're probably going to get Charlie Brown number two, you know, getting dumped on as well in some way, because they, for some reason, they cannot let go of that character. But all in all, I'm intrigued by it. I like where things are going. But at the same time, it's like you're kind of conditioned to expect certain things, and there are not a lot of huge surprises, really.
True. Now, I do like your point that Huey is in a position to make a difference. I do like that. That's probably the one redeeming thing about ending it this way with him. But he'd have to make a real sacrifice for me to care. Because again, you know, whenever there's a transition of a character, it's because something happens that marks them as markedly different from where they were before. Like when Luke loses his hand, or Anakin loses his limbs, or, you know, anything that the character, when they go through some type of metamorphosis, there's a sign or a symbol or a seal of something that I'm not the same as I used to be. Okay. And so this is what I would need from Huey to make him even remotely interesting to me. I haven't really seen that yet. But again, that's just me. Go ahead, Bracey.
Yeah, I found this really, really interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, with the finding out the congressman actually answered one particularly burning question for me. Not just who is the head popper, but how did she have access to so much? The one thing that kept bugging me is like, okay, the you know, being in the judiciary court, you know, like, oh, you know, we're gonna expose Vought and all this stuff. Okay, that was a public thing. A lot of people knew what was going on. But how did she know to pop the head of the CIA agent? It's like, oh, well, she's a congresswoman. She's got these kind of connections. She's on the download. They probably thought they were on the same side because she's got this anti-soups agenda. So somebody told her, and she was able to do that. Because it seems to be, seeing how she popped the head of the church, the head of the Scientology-type church, she seems to require line of sight to do her thing. So that's key, that she's got that going on. I tend to think her abilities are a very specialized form of telekinesis. I don't think she can throw around trucks and things like Jenny or the female's brother. You know, I think she's just very focused on the old head popping ability. We'll see if I'm right or wrong later on. But this once again brings me to question her motivation. She keeps sparing the boys when she could obviously kill anybody she wants. With the possible exception of somebody as powerful as Homelander. We don't know the extent of her abilities yet, but normal heads are easy enough to pop. And so she definitely knows who Huey and the gang are when Huey signs up to be on her campaign. So that's like creepy, like this point you guys are talking about, like if Huey's going to have to spy on her and she already knows what he's involved in, whoo, that's going to be some cat and mouse. But you notice she keeps protecting the interests of Vought, even though everything she says publicly goes against Vought and against superheroes. So that's really, really intriguing. What is her ultimate goal? What is her game? Really want to know what's happening there.
She's in bed with Edgar, I wonder.
I wouldn't be surprised if she's taking money from them. I mean, she is congresswoman.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots that can go down there. Huey, I felt a little better about him actually in this last episode because he, like you said, he didn't change a whole lot this season, but I like how they ended with him. Like, he grew a little spine. I like the fact they said, like, oh, you know, I got to get away from all this, but not from you, Starlight. I'm not going to do this song and dance anymore. Like, you and me were good. And so they finally put that to bed. Good. And the fact that he wanted to get away from this, he's wanted to get away from the violence and the subterfuge and the cloak and dagger for a while. And he wants to do what he can as a citizen to make a change. It's like so commendable. Like, it really made me like the guy more than I had in a while. And I don't think it's like his good decisions make bad decisions. I think Huey's superpower is to somehow always step in the dog shit. Because he just keeps falling into these bad situations, whether he wants to or not. Like, everything he does to avoid him, it keeps leading him back to like that spot. So that's oh man, poor Huey. He tries. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'll address is the Church of the Collective. Oh, go ahead.
I just want to throw this out quickly. The thing about Starlight and Huey and even Billy and Huey are better when they're grief-stricken over losing their loved ones. That's mm-hmm. kind of the core of how we met. But without that, they don't really have a lot to do. Starlight was better when she was having a crisis of faith and really questioning everything she believed growing up, from her faith to how she has her powers to, you know, basically having to start her life over. But that's a real journey, and it could have been really interesting, but that's not really what we got. And so they really didn't, Starlight and Huey really didn't have a lot to do all season long. That was the thing. That's what was really important. There's definitely more plan to go. But the last thing I'll say about that is, Brace, I'll let you finish, which is, when you write your characters with a Dawson's Creek level of romance, when it's work at best, you got nowhere to go past the infatuation. Billy and Becca were better. Okay, go ahead.
Well, while I agree with all that, I did like the fact that, because one of the things that kept bugging us was the fact that, like, they're like, oh, you know, we can't be together and we're not going to be together, but they were so obviously into each other. So I'm glad they just decided, like, all right, let's just do that.
Clark and Lana.
Yeah. But the last thing I'll talk about is the Church of the Collective. And the way they ended that whole thing is, you know, I feel like they weren't ever going to do anything interesting with them now. Either they wrote themselves into a corner, or the Church of the Collective was nothing but a plot device the whole season. It was just a way to get A-Train back into the Seven, another way to keep embarrassing the Deep, and a way to expose Stormfront. Because really, they didn't have any major impact outside of those things. Even though you can see, like, they've got, you know, the CEO of Vault on the phone, and, you know, they know the Congresswoman, so they're connected to all these things, but, like, okay, I guess that was kind of a nothing burger.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay, now, we don't need to talk about Homelander's final scene because it pretty much encapsulates everything the character is. Him wagging off over the city, trying to do whatever I want. Okay, we got it. But what I do want to talk
about. I can interject one quick thing about that. Believe it or not, that scene was actually shot in the first season. That scene was supposed to be an ender for the first season, and then it got rejected, and then they didn't like they were going to do the Superman thing where Homelander's sitting over the Earth looking down on it, like, with angry, glowing eyes, and Amazon felt like that was too derivative, so they allowed them to put the whacking off scene back in for the ender for this season.
All I know is my adult son and I were laughing our asses off about that. I'm wondering why they didn't. If they're going to put the seed in, they should have had him like shoot down an airplane or something, too. So.
I was expecting that.
That is the most Garth Ennis thing I've ever seen in this show, ever.
I was totally waiting for something like that to happen.
Yeah, sorry. It's just.
So let's get this straight. They didn't want to have him sitting on a cloud with the laser vision eyes. Wagging off over the city just fine. Okay, anyway. So let's talk about the final scene with Stormfront, because we are going to talk about the girls get it done scene. I'm already rolling my eyes. But anyway, let's talk about the final scene with Stormfront. Now, that is basically the ending of Billy Butcher's character. So I'm going to be interested to see how they bring him back. Because in the final scene with Stormfront, we saw coming a mile away from the moment we saw that the kid had power. We knew what was going to happen, because it's the oldest comic book trope in the world. You have an all-powerful something or anything, and nobody can beat him. So the one person that's been sitting all their power all this time all of a sudden has a rage burst. And that rage burst is always strong enough to beat the unbeatable. That's a very old comic trope. So we saw it coming. But it was the ending of everything the boys has been about. So my first question is, did Stormfront die? Because she's basically Anakin Skywalker at the end. So she's lost all her limbs. She was speaking in German, I think, and she was reciting some prayers. But she was still moving. So did she die? Or is she just going to come back regenerated? She's going to come back bionic? She's going to grow those limbs back? You know, like, what are they going to do with that? Number one. Number two, I knew Becca was going to die because Becca had to die, but I hated it. Just because you can see something coming doesn't mean you like it. And I hated it because all up until last episode, I liked her, but I liked the way her and Billy loved each other. And, but, you know, Butcher's like Batman. He can't be happy. So Becca had to die. Number three, I don't like the kid. I don't know if I'm supposed to like the kid, but I really don't like the kid. And the reason I don't like the kid is because he's just like every other superhero kid. He's like the Franklin Richards of the boys, because there seems to be a superhero law that the kid has to be more powerful than both parents put together, which I don't always agree with that. And then, finally, again, with where Butcher's going to go with this, and they're going to study the kid in the lab, and it all felt like the wrong thing to do given the circumstances. So those are kind of my thoughts on it. You know, I don't really care if we see Stormfront again or not, but if we do, she better be Darth Vader'd up, man. She better be even worse than before. But anyway, let me hear what you think. Start with Steve.
Yeah, I don't think she's dead. Short answer. I don't think she's dead. She really seemed like she was still moving. She was still speaking. If she took an awfully long time to die. If she died, I just don't really buy it. So my thinking is that whatever is keeping her alive, she can survive like anything, including dismemberment and things like this. I don't know about her regenerating. I think her turning cyborg is a little more likely. But yeah, I don't think that she's dead at all. As far as the kid, oh my God, how telegraphed that was. It's like, I can only use my heat vision for somebody I really hate, but I don't hate anybody. Well, that's obviously code for he's going to find somebody to hate, and then he's going to hate him so hard that he's going to vaporize this person. And, of course, that person is obviously Stormfront, because she's the most hateful character on this show. So, you know, it really was obvious. I hate that Becca died with her. I had actually thought that she wasn't going to die and that, you know, she was going to take the kid somewhere and raise the kid off by herself, because I was thinking, okay, well, if they kill her, who is they going to have to raise the kid? Because I didn't think that Butcher was going to do it, which indeed he did not. I did not really think of him going with Grace, though, but it is what it is. I really kind of sucks that they went for the obvious tragic ending. That I was rather disappointed with that, but, you know, yeah. Of course, nobody can be happy, especially if they're dark, brooding, tormented characters. So I roll my eyes at this and I move on. Generally speaking, though, I did kind of like the resolution, except for certain things. But I can kind of see where they came from, even if I disagreed with it. Perfectly solid, I would say, for the most part.
Okay. Go ahead, Bracey.
Yeah, I'm with Steve for the most part. You see what's coming, and at the same time, just like the scene we'll get into a little bit later when the girls get it done, there's a certain amount of satisfaction involved in it. Although, as is usual with these sort of things, I have questions, being the uber comic nerd that I am, about how superpowers work, because here's Stormfront, who's so incredibly invulnerable, and somehow Becca manages to stab her in the eye. So like she's been knocked through walls, and you know she takes heat vision like a champ, all this stuff. But okay, whatever. And then like when Homelander Jr. Heat vaporizes her, given the setup of the shot, he's on her right side, but the left side of her face is burned.
So, like, how? What? Come on, guys. A little. Like, I know I'm nitpicking on stuff, but, like, do some continuity checks. That would have made more sense. As far as I'm concerned, she's alive. She's laying on the ground speaking German. And her wounds are cauterized because, you know, it's the laser vision. It cauterizes the wounds. Yeah, she's in a lab somewhere being heavily experimented on, I'm sure. They're going to pick her apart and see what they can do with her. But I'm sure also somebody will probably try and find a way to make her useful. It's not the first time that she's changed her identity, so we could easily see her come back once again in another form. So keep your eyes open for that if the writers decide to go that way. I would not be surprised to see this. I also don't quite understand what happened to Becca, because it couldn't have been the kid who killed her, because he'd have just lasered her head right off. So I guess Stormfront's finger spasmed when she got shot, and her thumb punctured Becca's carotid artery or something. And that was a little weird for me. It's like even in a fantasy setting, certain things need to make sense. I kind of demand that. You know, I'm willing to suspend disbelief for a lot of things. But even doing that, in the logic of the world you built, things have to work within that logic. So that's where I'm at. Other than that, like you guys said, like Steve said, the scene was predictable. You knew what was going to happen. The setup was so obvious. The foreshadow was more like a four eclipse. Like, you know, it really helps if I hate somebody sometimes. Like, yeah, that's totally going to happen. So it wasn't very subtle, but in the end, it's kind of like when King Joffrey gets killed in Game of Thrones. You just want to see it happen. So mm-hmm. I was able to forgive a lot for that.
Oh, that was one of the most satisfying deaths ever. I just have to say.
Yes. Me and my
non-deaths, but yeah.
Oh, we're talking about Joffrey.
Pretty much predicting that Mallory's going to fall in love with the kid and then lose him again. Because Mallory works better when she's bitter and crazy, too. So I think she's going to get really attached to this kid, and then he's going to die. But just throwing that out. Go ahead, Nemesis.
Yeah, a couple things that I just want to add. First, the eye thing. Yeah, it definitely didn't make sense to me. One of my favorite moments of that Superman Returns movie is when Superman tanks the bullet with his eye, you know, and it, like, just clanks right off his eye. I thought, yeah, that's cool. So, you know. That was one thing. Two, we've already heard from the showrunner and the actress herself that Stormfront isn't dead. So she is indeed going to be back in some form, which just begs the question is she going to come back at, you know, Darth Vader, as you put it, or does she have some version of Black Noir's powers and can regenerate, what is going to happen there? So I'm curious to see how that will work and what's going to happen. But yeah, unless I completely not remembering right, the question was asked, and I believe the showrunner and the actress both confirmed that she is going to be back. So I'm pretty sure that is, you know, go ahead and check that, but I'm 99% sure that that's true. And then as far as her actual death and everything, I mean, we all knew. It's what we wanted. It's what the fans wanted for this whole time. She's the character we love to hate. And so you had to have, on some visceral level, everybody wanted to see her get the crap kicked out of her and end up like that. I don't know. You know, I'm not sure how I feel about the whole thing. You know, the stuff with the kid, I guess that's the last thing I'll comment on. I don't know if I agree with DT. I see what he's saying, but I'm wondering if this is the last time we're ever going to see that kid, that they're just going to put him away in a CIA safe house and he's gone. You know, that was kind of the feeling I got when they're shuffling him into the, you know, it was almost like he is the church of the collective in human form, you know? So it's like, he's been a plot device this whole season. And now we've used him as a plot device to get Becca out of the way and, you know, do the stuff with Stormfront and everything else. And now here, get in the limo or the car and go to the CIA safe house. And we're going to put you there for the next 20 years in show, which, you know, means we'll never see him again. So that's kind of the feeling I got out of it.
Well, one thing I will say is that I'm not going to say it's a mistake, but they have brought to a conclusion every single storyline and arc that made the show interesting from the first season. So the third season of this show is going to be a completely different show. And that doesn't mean it's going to be good or bad. It's just going to be completely different. The whole thing was that they had an image. They were the Justice League, but they were the crime syndicate in private. And they didn't want anybody to know that. They were chosen by God. They didn't want anybody to know about Compound V. Madeline Stiller, her whole job was spin and points and followers and what's trending. Same with the girl that's doing now. I forget her name. The whole thing was about Starlight Shock. She's the point of view character. She thought what the Seven actually was, and the fact that she found out she had a Hollywood mom. Billy was traumatized because his girlfriend was pulverized, and Mallory was bitter and could barely speak to Billy because her grandkids got burned alive. I mean, every single thing that we loved about this show has been resolved. So that's what I mean when I say it doesn't mean the next season is going to be bad. It could be great, but it's going to be a different show from what we've seen. And the only thing possible that could remain to carry over, besides the Congresswoman, is Stormfront coming back and the kid. And if they don't do either one of those, then we're going to have a whole bunch of new stuff. Okay, so let's talk about the girls get it done scene. Did you laugh? Did you cheer? Did you cringe? The one shocking moment I had was I really thought Kimiko was dead, and I was like, wait a minute. Please don't tell me they killed her. But then I forgot her power is to unsnap her neck and just come on back. I'm like, oh, okay, great. Woo! Because I thought she was gone. But in terms of that scene, I thought it was, how can I say this? I thought it was good. I thought it was fun. But I thought it was overly long if they weren't really going to stop her. I think it was more the Maeve redemption scene idea, because they didn't really stop her. It was the kid that stopped her. They beat her up a lot, so that was good. I guess that was emotional release. That was catharsis for everybody. But they didn't really stop her. So I thought it went on kind of long if they weren't going to be the ones to shut her down. But give me your thoughts about that scene. Start with Nemesis.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you. I think it's just, you know, to steal an anime term, it was fan service. I mean, that's really what it was. Everybody wanted to see their ass beat. And, you know, and this day and age, you knew damn well that, you know, even if there were males that could beat her, they weren't going to come in and do it. So, you know, we needed the girls to get it done. And seeing Kimiko, that was an awesome moment, by the way. I mean, that really cemented her. It took, I think, took her character as far as powers-wise to the next level, you know, which was great to see. But seeing the three of them get in there and seeing Maeve grow a spine and show up and do something was pretty badass. So, you know, it was very satisfying that way, and I didn't have a problem with this at all. I enjoyed it. So I like a good girl fight every now and then. So
go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about it. I think it's emotionally satisfying because we want to see these three take her out. We especially want Kimiko to get in some good hits because of what she's lost. You know, she's trying to avenge her brother, and so she's the one with the most motivation to kick the crap out of Stormfront. And it's nice to see her do it. She gets a really great moment where before she starts wailing on her, which is nice. My only concern really is Maeve, honestly, because I don't feel like we really saw why she decided to suddenly grow a conscience, especially after she went off on Huey and Starlight earlier in the episode, you know, about, oh, nothing ever changes. And, you know, you need to take the twink and get the F out of here. It's like after that, you just kind of like, OK, well, we know she's going to turn around and she comes back. But I just don't see the transformation. And it doesn't seem convincing, but at the same time, we get the emotional aspect of, okay, she comes around because she knows deep down that this is the right thing to do. Okay, that's nice, but I kind of wanted to see the turn. I wanted to see the dark night of the soul. I wanted to see, you know, her wrestle with this and decide, you know, yeah, I'm going to go and I'm going to do this one good thing. Not just because Starlight is my, well, I guess, I don't know if friend exactly is what I would call it, but, you know, the one person that I actually don't hate on the team. So I would have liked to have seen that. But in terms of Starlight in there, it was fine. And in terms of Kimiko, it was great. Though I agree, you kind of wish that Kimiko could have gotten the death blow in on Stormfront. And unfortunately, it doesn't turn out that way. But it's at least nice for her to get some comeuppance and some revenge in the middle of that. I just feel like Maeve's arc could have been better handled.
Good point. Good point, and I agree. We're glad that she turned, but we didn't see her turn, so we still need to know why and what that means for her life. Go ahead, Bracey.
Yeah, I'm a lot like Steve. I enjoyed this scene a lot. It was very cathartic. It's something I've been waiting on. In the comics, Stormfront, the comic iteration of Stormfront gets taken down by a group effort, so that's kind of what I was hoping to see here, especially because Kimiko was in on there. As well as Starlight, and then you know, Maeve's like, oh, okay, Maeve's made the turn. Once again, it's all very satisfying. We've all been wanting to see this, and I think it would have actually been far more appropriate for the girls to just beat the crap out of her and beat her into some sort of coma. That would have been more satisfying for me than the way they decide to end things. My major problems with it, though, are once again, the world has built its own internal logic. Starlight absorbs electricity. That's how she gets her power. She takes electricity, she sucks it up, and she converts it into bursts of light. Stormfront is throwing electricity at her. This should have been like if you guys are One Piece fans, this should have been the moment where Luffy fights the Lightning Lord in Skytopia, or you know, like where he turns out, oh, I'm made out of rubber, so I'm immune to electricity. She should have just been like, you know, maybe like Kimiko is getting her, you know, she's Stormfront's too tough. And then it's not just Maeve coming in. The fact that Starlight comes in, she starts trying to blast her. And she's like, oh, that doesn't work on me. And she just runs up. But she's not as physically powerful as Stormfront. So Stormfront still ends up having the advantage because she's just that strong and that tough until Maeve shows up. Which brings me to the other thing that bugs me. Where did Maeve come from?
Yeah.
She can't fly.
Right.
I know she can't fly. How did she even know where to go? It's just, I can't stand that kind of plot convenience. Even when I enjoy the scene, it just nags me to death. I cannot stand it. So, mixed bag, little good, little bad. Wish it ended with the girls actually getting it done, which is kind of ironic. You know, like there's Frenchie, like, girls really do get it done, except that they didn't.
Yeah, I would say one thing. Maeve coming back was like Poe coming back in the end of The Force Awakens after he'd been dead. Do they explain anything? No. Do they, you know, why does he come back? How does he know to get there? Never explained. We don't care. You know, it feels good that he's back, but, you know, it makes no sense. And it's the same here with Maeve.
Exactly. I have to interject, too, that at this point in the show, you know, like I said, the ending hooked me for season 3. At this point in the show, I was just holding on because we talk about it and everything. So I was looking at, I wasn't even thinking about Maeve. I was just looking at this like a run-in in wrestling. You know, I was like, oh, look, Maeve is doing a run-in. So, you know, I didn't care where she came from as long as she had a chair in her hand, you know. So
she rolled out from underneath the ring.
Yeah, you know, and then the other thing, I mean, really, that's what I was sitting there thinking. The other thing I was thinking, I don't know if this is true in everybody's high school or if it's only true if you went to a rough high school or something, but I appreciated the fact that all the guys stood back and watched the girl fight, because the one thing I learned at my high school is if you're a guy and you get into a girl fight, you're going to get your ass kicked, you know. So it's like you don't interfere in girl fights. Those things are brutal and raw, and men do have no place in there because nothing good can happen. So just sit back on the sidelines.
They got nails, man. They got nails.
You stay on.
It's only safe when they get their hands tangled in each other's hair. Yeah. Then you can safely get in there.
I saw a vice principal try to break up a girl fight once, and I've never seen a man get torn up so bad. That's all I'm going to say.
Wow.
They are brutal.
Sounds like a movie. Okay, very quickly, because Rod's gone. but I want to do this very quickly. Let's go around quickly and make our predictions for season three. I've already given you mine, but I'll repeat them. I think Mallory's going to fall in love with the kid and then lose the kid and then get bitter again. I have no idea what they're going to do with Billy Butcher. Just no idea. I think Stormfront's coming back with a different personality, but bionic Vadered up, and maybe that's going to affect the way she thinks. I think that Starlight and Maeve are both going to embrace being more of a hero again instead of being like a dark hero. I think Homelander is going to be Homelander because he's the only character that doesn't need to change because it's the Homelander show. We don't really want to see him be anybody else. And I think Huey is going to have to make a major sacrifice to even be relevant after these last two seasons. So really quickly, let me hear your predictions on season three. Go ahead, Nemesis.
I think Butcher is going to be even more jaded, and I don't think he has any really connection to anything, so I think he's just going to turn into an even worse version of himself. You know that nothing good is going to happen. You know, something bad is going to happen from Mother's Milk and Frenchie. Huey is going to be just another train wreck, you know, in motion. We're going to see everything fall apart, you know, except this time, instead of his girlfriend getting exploded, it's going to be his life he's holding in his hands, and it's just going to get exploded by whatever's happening. And then, God, please, don't let us get the deep again. Let him go retire to the Marianas Trench or something. And, we'll see what happens. You know, my biggest question is Stormfront, where that's going to come from. I definitely want to see what happens with Newman. Was it Congressman Newman? And, And what are they going to do with the Seven? You know, what is the Seven's role in this new world that they've created within, you know, the Boys universe? So, because, like you said, I think that point was really great, what you said, which is they have pretty much put to bed or killed every single story arc, idea, building block that this show started with. So they are really on a clean slate for season three, which could be great or it could be horrible. So curious. I'm very curious.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I would say they either have to create a lot of stuff or prepare for season three to be the last season of The Boys. I'm kind of hoping that doesn't happen. I'm hoping that they can, you know, find new grist for the mill and to keep things going. But if what they come up with is not enough, I have a feeling that we're not going to see more than a couple seasons left. That having been said, I'm hoping that Huey ends up kind of in a position where Starlight has been, where she's kind of torn between the two sides and, you know, having to make a decision. But I hope that they don't Charlie Brown him too much along the way. I know they're going to because they're Huey. He's Huey and they can't stop themselves. But, you know, I'm hoping that that he can actually, towards the end, actually get out from under that and make something of himself. That would be nice. Butcher just lost his moral compass. So I think he's going to get nastier and surlier more than likely, especially with Huey, you know, working for Newman. I don't know about the others. I have a feeling that we're going to see more Frenchie and Kimiko, like, learning sign language, probably. I'm not sure what else to do with Mother's Milk now that he's able to see his family, so they're going to probably have to throw a wrench in that. They're going to keep him interesting. And then as far as the Seven, I have imagined that there probably will be, like, new tryouts. I imagine, unfortunately, that we're going to see the Deep trying to worm his way back in, and I hope we don't, because I am tired of the Deep. I am so sick of the Deep, but these people love to make fun of him, and it's just getting tiresome, so I hope they don't, but I have a feeling they will. And Stormfront, I think we probably will see her in some kind of Vadered bionic form, and I can see her being more hateful and more nasty and wanting to kill a lot of people on both sides. She's kind of at the point where she doesn't have any friends left, and she's in a bad place. And she's, you know, and I can see if Stormfront having lost her humanity, having nothing to lose, being really, really vicious. And that could be interesting. But I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Go ahead, Bracey.
All right. Stormfront does come back somewhat like Black Noir, covered up head to toe, maybe limited speech, maybe no speech. But she's totally coming back Darth Vader style. Huey is going to have to play a cat and mouse game with Newman. I have to agree with everybody's predictions on that. And probably very seriously prompted by Butcher and or maybe Mallory. I think the kid's gone. I think Nemesis was spot on like with that. I was in the same boat. I was like, oh, we'll probably never see this kid again. Let's see. I think the season is probably going to end finally with something happening and the boys acquiring Compound V. And I think the season ender will be them shooting up with Compound V to get you into season 4. And in a surprising turn of events, the Deep is going to come back stronger than ever and just take charge of everything.
Would be nice. I would like to see that. I don't think it will, but I would love to be wrong.
Can you smell the sarcasm?
My goodness. I'm with Nemesis, man. He can go somewhere to Aquaman's trench and get eaten by the Atlantean munchkins. And on that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Umbrella Academy Season 2, Episode 8. So we're going to let you hear a few words from my sponsors, and then we'll jump right in. All right, everybody take 5, and we'll be back shortly.
Beyond the world of DC and Marvel, there is a world that opens the imagination in ways that you've never known. The world of indie comics is here, with comic books that you didn't even know existed. Thanks to Dodgy, Al Mega, and the random dude Josh, you too will have your eyes open to new books in the indie comic universe. Check out Flipside Focus, only on the Undercover Capes Podcast Network.
All right, everybody, welcome back. We're going to talk about Umbrella Academy Season 2, Episode 8. It's that we've got more episodes to go to get to this season finale. Now, right off the bat, I'm going to agree with and identify with something that Bracey said in our last segment, and that is that I am a stickler for details, and I have a pedantic interest in how superpowers work. Mm-hmm. So I'm one of those, you hear me say it all the time when I use my phrase, to put the camera in the wrong place.
Yeah.
That's what they didn't understand about the Terminator franchise, is that they exhausted the human story in the present. But there's so much more they could have done with Reese's character and how the time machine was really built, because we only got a glimpse of that and how the time travel really worked and a whole bunch of stuff they could have done. Because I personally love stuff like that. I'm one of the geeks that loves Trekno-Babble. So whenever Geordi's talking about cross-referencing the deflector dish, you the main relays, and then the drive plasma, and I'm just like, yes! Give me more! So, having said all that, the crux of this episode is their own time travel rules. And it was kind of good, and it was kind of bad. And that was that we had a clear outlining of what happens when you create the temporal paradox of confronting a different version of yourself. Because as you've heard me say on Twitter millions of times, you've got to pick a set of time travel rules, because time travel is already janky to begin with. And don't get me started on Endgame, because they totally lost me halfway through that movie. Avengers Endgame, I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. Yep. My mind just checked out. I'm like, whatever. Because I just stopped caring. But you got to use one of the three basic sets. Okay, time travel set number one is the Terminator universe, which is everything that happens is all in the same universe. So if you change the past, you change the future will morph around you. Because that's the whole premise of Terminator.
Yep.
It has to be in the same universe if we're going to kill John Connor. That means we're taking him out so we don't have to deal with him later. So it has to work that way. There's that. Then there's the Back to the Future model, which says whenever you change anything in the past, you create a separate alternate future and you may or may not lose the original one, but all the changes that you make split the time stream into a different lane that didn't exist until you did what you did. And then there's the 12 monkeys theory, which says you can't change the past. The past is already written, so anything that you try to do is just going to end up causing the very thing you were trying to change. So I know there are other models, but those are the basic three that I see used the most often. So whichever one you're going with, you kind of have to pick one and stay with it. Otherwise, it completely loses its meaning. So this whole episode is based around the idea of the seven stages of the temporal paradox of confronting a different version of yourself. And so it's kind of looper territory. It's kind of a looper idea, which is a combination of time travel ideas. But so the setup was really good, but then it kind of devolves into like fart and paranoia jokes. And I was like, that's all you guys are going to do with this, especially with your most interesting character. So, you know, in terms of the paradox psychosis and taking it to its extreme, I thought there was a lot more that could have been done writing wise, but it just felt like we went to all this trouble to get this incredible confrontation, but then it's just kind of juvenile joked away. I don't know, maybe that was just me. So let me hear your thoughts on that whole thing. Start with Bracey.
Yeah, I'm like you. They took my favorite character, Five, and they took him a step down with the whole thing with him meeting himself. Because, like, him meeting his future, quote, past self, because he's little boy Five is actually technically older than old man Five.
Right.
So I love the idea of that paradox right there. That's really super interesting. And I like time travel movies. I like time travel shows. I like time travel paradoxes. I think going down those rabbit holes is really fascinating. But this whole weird time travel dementia kind of thing that goes on, I was like, really? Fart jokes? That's no, you don't do that to Five. Do that to Luther or Diego. Those are the guys that happens to. You don't do that to Five. You don't make Five a joke. And so as much as I wanted to get into that particular part of the show, it was really annoying and really disappointing. Because the part I really loved was like Five trying to outguess himself, because he's like, he's going to try something. I know it. What makes you that? Because I'm him and that's what I do. You know, that's fun. That is so much fun. But, you know, just man. And then, like, you know, Luther's such an idiot in this, because I'm being a little unfair. Luther's not expressly an idiot, but he's a follower. Five is a leader. And so he's following whichever Five seems to be the most dominant at the time. And old man Five seems like, yeah, we got to kill me and that'll fix the timeline. He's like, okay, sounds good enough to me. I don't understand quantum mechanics anyway. So it could have been better. It could have been a lot more fun. It was interesting at the outset, but, you know, the lame joke ruined it for me.
Well, you said it right. And that is that Luther is an idiot, so you don't have to take that back. Luther found his place when he first went back in time, and he just became the muscle for a mob boss. Mm. Do you remember how he defended that life? And he was a boxer, a pugilist. Remember how he defended that life when they wanted him to get back in the fray? Because Luther finally found where he fit. He knows he's not as smart as anybody around him.
Well, like I said, he's a follower, and that fit him perfectly. Somebody give me orders.
Right. So when you start getting into somebody trying to negotiate or be a mediator or build bridges, no. He's nowhere near the kind of character where that would even be remotely taken seriously. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay. I missed the last episode because I wasn't here. And so I may be missing a couple of points, but it seems to me like Five has been a bit dumber this episode than what really he should be. And this particular thing particularly kind of got me, because I'm here I am thinking, okay, if I'm five and I know that this will happen and I don't remember seeing myself in the past, would I directly confront myself, especially knowing who I am and what I'm like? And I'm like, I have a guy over here who's perfectly willing to be my intermediary. Why am I not using him instead of taking away my only real asset, which is that I am smarter than most of the people around, and I have more experience than my younger self, which is the only edge you really have over you. So, I'm going to confront him directly, thus taking away my only edge, which is that I'm rational and that I'm a thinker. And I'm just like, can't you find some way to use Luther to get the briefcase away from him? Other than that, did you really have to like directly confront him and directly tell him everything? Couldn't you find some way to trick yourself? I don't know anything other than what you actually did. So, between that and the other question that I'm going to be dealing with later, which is if you could get the answers of what happened by just going to the commission's security room, why not do that? So, overall, five really comes across as not as smart as he should be. And it's unfortunate because Aidan Gallagher is really good. And the guy that plays the younger/older five is quite good, too. And it is nice to see them together, but the narrative logic bringing them together just does not work, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and it makes both of them dumber for my having watched it.
Well, just to throw in the writer's code, and I agree with what you're saying, we always expect that type of confrontation to be greater than the sum of its parts. So in other words, if 1-5 is good, 2-5s ought to be better.
Hmm.
But fortunately, 2-5s were worse because they did dumb them down for no discernible reason. Maybe they didn't know what to do with having, 2-5s in the mix. But anyway, go ahead, Nemesis.
I think that this scene perfectly encapsulates the problem I'm having with this series as a whole. And that, yes, the Umbrella Academy, the comics, and this series, it has a lot of wackiness. It has a lot of just pure comic fun to it. The characters sometimes do things that are ridiculous or whatever. But the problem is with this series is that they find themselves sometimes in very serious situations or very situations that are loaded with potential for genuine geekiness or genuine sci-fi intellectual thought, or action or whatever. And this series in particular never fails to see the potential and turn away from it and do a 180 and go the opposite direction. And that is true. Exactly what they did here with five. So if this was Luther trying to figure out all the vagaries of the paradox and how to navigate it and everything, it wouldn't ring true. But this is five we're talking about. There are some other characters that possibly could have pulled this off. Maybe if we did, we've done some fairly serious stuff with the civil rights stuff. But when it comes to the comic stuff, when it comes to science fiction, when it comes to the nerdiness, the comic book aspects of it, they don't want to get into it at all. They just want to be goofy and do goofy things. And the fart jokes and everything, I'm in absolute agreement with you guys. I was worried I was the only one, that I was being an old fogey, because I was like, I hate this. I absolutely hate this. This is terrible. This is ridiculous. This is turning five into a farce, And honestly, if this was five really thinking the way five thinks, knowing that he's in a bar, five arrives there in time and has somebody that, and bribes the bartender to put something in the older self or the younger self's drink and just knocks him out that way or something. It wouldn't have even had to be that complicated. But instead, the writers wanted to create up this farcical situation and have fart jokes and all this other crap. And it's just a waste of an opportunity to do something really good. And it really is disappointing to me, especially since the comics have that same sense. I'm reading the comics now. I'm reading the new series. Has that same sense of craziness and wonder and everything else. But when they hit points that are legitimately serious, they do them the right way. They do it in a comic booky science fiction way, and this series never fails to disappoint by not going there.
Okay. Let me throw in a writer's code quote, and then we'll move on to the next topic. Here's the thing. Whenever you establish a character as being able to either think their way out of a situation and or fight their way out of a situation, then you put them in a situation where they can't do either. You have to have a really good reason. You can't just say all of a sudden they're dumb now for the sake of this plot point. No. If we've been watching them outthink everybody around them, if we've been watching them outfight everybody around them, and then all of a sudden they're just helpless, no, that's never going to sell. It's never going to fly unless you have got a very good reason for it to be happening, which is a good transition to the next thing I want to talk about, next thing we kind of have to talk about, which is Vanya, the Russian spy. Okay, now, based on what Nemesis just said, I think he perfectly encapsulated what they do with Vanya this episode, because I really wanted to see more before it got resolved, because she was in a situation where it was very reminiscent of how she grew up and it ended up triggering her memories. But it was a situation where it was a brilliant piece of writing in terms of the setup, because I love it when they have setups where everything you do makes you look guilty, but the audience knows you're not. But the antagonist in the scene thinks you are, and every piece of information they have, they draw the conclusion that you must be guilty or you must be what they're looking for or whatever. But as the audience, we know that's not the case. The explanation is different. I love that kind of tension, because you're really going to have to grow as a character and as a person to get out of it unless you comic book your way out. So what they end up doing here is, sometimes Vanya is just repressed, and sometimes she's a victim, and sometimes she's misunderstood, and then sometimes she's just basically White Violin, which is her version of Dark Phoenix. So I'm like, you need to make up your mind as to what that journey is. Is she all those other things and she has rage-based powers, or is she really just kind of doing like the Dark Phoenix movie, like, you know, she really likes it, like as a part of her that's just really, really dark, and she's always trying to keep it in check, or like, what is her deal? And so I really liked the setup. I really liked her having to go back in her mind and having kind of like, you know, the acid trip nightmare memory thing. That was cool. But then she just, you know, triggers her Dark Phoenix White Violin powers, and all of a sudden she's automatically stronger than everybody and everything and just blasts her way out of the situation. But at least we get the answer to what's been bugging us since episode one, which is, you know, what really happens on this time trip. And that is that her presence gets interpreted as a Russian attack, and it escalates. It saves JFK's life, but it escalates into the war that we see in the first episode. So at least we finally get that little piece tied off. But again, she's starting to feel like not a deus ex machina, but maybe a kind of a catch-all character.
Yeah.
That if we can't get out of anything, just blame Vanya.
Well, can I interject something real quick here?
Yes, yes, yes.
You know how you and Jeff and we're talking about how you notice those things and they bug you? Well, one of those things happened to me with Vanya here. And that's why I wanted to get it out before everybody else talked about it, because the driving force here, the reason that Vanya has been arrested by the FBI and everything, is because she spoke Russian. Why was she speaking Russian? She was knocked out. She's speaking, you know, if you get knocked out and you're muttering in your sleep, you're speaking in the language you think in, but she never grew up in Russia. She was taken as a child and reared by British-speaking or English-speaking people in the United States. So why was she speaking Russian?
I always just assumed that Hargreaves had him learn a number of languages.
Right.
It's yeah, that's what
convenient,
I think.
Very convenient that she happened to be speaking Russian.
Right. But that's awfully convenient. Awfully yeah. convenient.
And the primary language when you're unconscious and you're speaking
your native tongue.
Is the language you think in. Right, your native tongue. Mm-hmm. You may learn a lot of different languages, but you don't think. You usually only think in one language. There are some people who could think in multiple languages, but that is rare. So why was she speaking Russian? Makes no sense to me. And right away, that took me completely out of it. That told me right there that she is exactly what DT was talking about. She is, let's use this character to drive the plot forward. Everything will throw it on Vanya. And that's what this was. It's like, oh, her name is Vanya, so we'll just have her speak Russian. It's like, but meanwhile, the geeks are sitting here watching it going, why is she speaking Russian? And so for me, it completely took me right out of the plot. So sorry, I just had to throw that out there.
Oh, no problem. It also, because you've heard me say this many times before as well, as far as I'm concerned, if you're going to do civil rights and if you're going to do McCarthy, which they've done, you have to have sentinels, okay? There's got to be something in the future that comes out of this to where we see metahumans, we see enhanced individuals, as Captain America calls them. There would have to be some response on that level because they keep saying that their presence just triggers kind of the global war, but it doesn't seem to be any type of strike force against them. And you can't have this kind of scene and somebody somewhere doesn't start a Sentinel program. So if you're going to be the X-Men, I mean, like, be the X-Men. Don't just be like the half X-Men, you know. Anyway, go ahead, Steve.
I'm kind of with Nemesis on this. I didn't entirely buy this either, and I did ask a question about the Russian. The other thing that kind of bothered me was the thing that the script itself tells you, which is, why would a Russian agent hang out on a farm with two nobodies? Nobody answers this question even remotely, and you can kind of tell even they didn't have an answer, because the answer that the husband gives is ridiculous. It's just stupid. They just don't have any answer whatsoever for this. So those were the two things that kind of got me. I will say that I did like the acid trip with the Butthole Surfers music. I'm like, oh my god, this is one of those points where the musical selection and the visuals just complement each other perfectly, and it really brings you into that moment. But the problem is that all of this comes together in a narrative that doesn't quite work. And then it also, in addition to that, with the whole Vanya is the bomb thing, we end up retroactively making the Umbrella Academy look stupid, because then the question is, why didn't they do something about Vanya when they had a chance? You know, why is there nobody debating about why they shouldn't kill her? I mean, you know, it ends up making them look ridiculous, because here's twice where, you know, she goes completely Dark Phoenix and screws up the world, and nobody is learning anything from their experiences at all. And so this is another case where that comes back to. I mean, on one level, it's like you can kind of see what they're trying to do, but when it comes to the execution, it just makes the characters look worse than they should be. And I will say one thing in its favor, and that is at least things are happening now, and we're not like going around in circles with these relationship problems. But at the same time, it's not worth the wait for things to finally happen, and then things don't add up.
At the very least, you think Five would entertain the idea of killing her. So.
Yeah. Oh, he would certainly say that, yeah. And yeah. Diego, I think, would too.
Without hesitation, because he'd be the one to be able to figure out that's the only alternative. Either we're going to have to keep her drugged and live with the fact that our sister has to be sedated constantly, or we have to take her out. He would come to that bottom line faster than anybody. So, yeah. Go ahead, Bracey.
Yeah, I just keep hating Vanya lately. Not because of the scene, but just because of the whole thing about her. Because you do bring up a really good point that just made me think about this. If we're going to have this sort of thing where these apocalypses keep happening centered around a central figure, the Umbrella Academy is always at the center of these things. Where is the response to that? Where are the Sentinels? Or in this case, I keep asking, where is the Commission?
Mm-hmm.
If the Commission's whole deal is to fix broken timelines, why haven't they killed Vanya? Why didn't they kill her when she was sedated? Why are they not concerned with about fixing the whole JFK, we're about to have World War III thing right now? If that's their whole mandate, unless somehow they know it's all going to work out in the end. That's the only out I can see, because we see later that Diego sees how things play out. So that just doesn't, I'm like you, DT, it doesn't make sense to me. There's no response to that. And I'm still very firmly in the camp. I'm bringing out my inner five. Vanya's got to go. And whether I tell the rest of the family what happened to her or not, she's just going to disappear one day. Sedatener's not going to do it. You can't take the chance. She's got to go. It's like Diego's finally realizing Vanya's the bomb. She's always going to be the bomb. That aside, though, getting back into the scene itself, I thought the scene was really, really good. I love the interrogation. I thought it was really clever the way that they trick her into speaking Russian in the interrogation. And, the framing of her versus the other characters, the fact that they come up with some clever way to keep her from actively using her powers, although they never really get into, like, not in a satisfying way, as like, oh yeah, how did you throw those cops around? But nobody, when they search her, they don't find any devices on her, any weapons, anything like that. They don't even bring up like the idea of like back in the day, the government being checking out psychic research as a potential weapon, men who stare at goats kind of thing. Nothing like that. The remote viewing is like, even just an in-world explanation is like, maybe there's been talk of the Russians having super secret development of psychic powers or something. So they've got a means to control a person with superpowers without really addressing the fact that she's got superpowers. So that was a little weird. But I still like the whole framing of the thing. And Ellen, Elliot, whatever you want to call her, played the scene very well, I thought. And I like I did like the head trip too. And like, once again, this is one of the things that the Umbrella Academy does so well, marrying perfect music with a perfect scene. So on point with like the Butthole Surfers and the head trip. And I just love that whole thing where they're in there eating brains. And it's like, oh yeah, man, the metaphors are so great. And it all worked so beautifully. So I still hate on the character right now. This season's really made me hate the character, but I love this particular scene.
I will say this one thing. I had flashbacks to this old music video with Tom Petty where they're in Alice in Wonderland and they're eating Alice as a cake. It is that great level of freaking bizarre. And I will say that scene with the acid trip.
It's so appropriate. The metaphor, isn't it? Like she's got to consume her own memories to restore them.
Yeah, I will say it's up there with the kiss fight from a few episodes ago. It's up there.
The music has been great this season. And for all of you out there who don't know what Shane Weaver was talking about, go on YouTube, check out Don't Come Around Here No More by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. So
definitely worth checking out, and definitely had the right level of bizarre for what we're doing. Now, that's pretty much the only things that happened in the episode of significance we've already talked about. So very briefly, I'll touch on Harlan getting powers, which is kind of a cheat, but we have to get to some further episodes to kind of see how that plays out. But they just keep underscoring how selfish Vanya is. And, that's a difference between her and Jean Grey. We love Jean Grey. If you know anything about Jean Grey from the comics, not the movies. I ain't talking about the movies. The movies haven't done any of them justice, except maybe Nightcrawler. But from the comics, Jean Grey was the world's most unaware telepath. She's an oxymoron, because literally all the men around her were in love with her. And she didn't know it. She didn't get it, because she was so unself-aware of her beauty and her the way she carried herself. Everybody loved Jean. Readers loved Jean. Jean was kind of quiet background, very, very shy, afraid to be too aggressive with her power. That was always who she was. So when she emerges as Phoenix and then as the Black Queen and then as Dark Phoenix, it was just such a stark contrast. What they're doing with Vanya is like the opposite. Like, I started off liking her a lot more than I do now. They're making you hate this girl because her worldview is small and completely self-centered. And she's the kind of person that's saying, I don't care who I have to hurt as an adult because I was deprived of what I needed as a child. Now, that is truly a tragedy. And there are a lot of people that go through that. If you didn't get what you needed out of your childhood, you've had a very rough time of it. And nobody would argue that. But when you try to make the argument, that makes anything I do okay as an adult, and it doesn't matter who I hurt because I'm going to get mine, that's who Vanya's turned out to be. And it's just, they're having a negative downward spiral with her arc as opposed to Allison. Allison started off and she came off as really bratty. She was really a mean girl, but we've seen her this year grow up and be a woman that took her power seriously, took her place in the world seriously, fell in love, maintained a marriage, joined a movement, and really kind of came into her own as a person separate from her abilities. So that's the way to do that. But it's really been amazing how they've gone in such extreme directions. So the only other thing to talk about is something that I'm already bored bringing it up, but we kind of have to bring it up. And that's the Swedish meatballs. You know, I'm just so glad they're done, you know, and I know that, you know, we know what's going to happen, so won't spoil that. But I just want to go a writer's code on it for a minute that I hear from you guys. And that is, you know, you've really got to have a purpose for these kinds of things. If you want to have a scene example of villains that live on the periphery, but they're always real threats, that would be like the Reavers in the Firefly world. Because the Reavers were always, always a real incredible threat. And as we saw in the movie Serenity, spoiler alert, people died, you know, Book died because of the operative, but Wash died because of the Reavers. And all of them got hurt. And if River hadn't gone super soldier at the last minute, they all would have been taken out. That's the way you write a credible threat.
Mm-hmm.
You have a villain that's supposed to be scary or supposed to be. I never could figure out what they were supposed to be. Are they like Terminators? Are they the ghost dudes from the Matrix? Like, what were they? So, they still have come up like a big nothing burger to me. Why were you that writer's code assessment of the Swedish meatball? Why were you there? So we'll close out on that thought. Let me hear what you guys think about that. Start with Nemesis.
About the Swedish guys or just that thought in general?
About the Swedish meatballs.
Yeah, I mean, once again, they're like Vanya. You know, there's a lot of that in this series. There's a lot of people, situations, characters that are just plot devices. They're never fully thought out. They're never fully fleshed out. And they're never fully realized. There was other stuff. You know, I know that we're running out of time, but, you know, in a similar vein in this episode in particular, what was the whole thinking of bringing Diego to the commission? Did that really make any sense from any standpoint if you're thinking about it from characters? And it's the same thing with these Swedish guys. What was their whole purpose the whole time? They are the church of the collective for this season of the Umbrella Academy. Hmm. You know, that's really what it comes down to. And it's kind of sad. It's like, you know, I don't know what it's like for every writer and everything. And, you know, a lot of us fall in love with different ideas. We've talked about that before. Maybe this was a cool idea that someone thought of. But whatever it is, you have a limited amount of time and space to tell your story and do things within it. And, you know, if something isn't working, you know, we were talking about this before we came on air. Sometimes you got to cut your baby. You know, even if you really love it, if it's not serving a purpose, it needs to go. And this is one of those ideas that that's what it felt like from a writer's code perspective. It's like, oh, we have this great idea for these three brothers who are Swedish and they're assassins and everything. And wouldn't it be cool to have them? Well, yeah, they're a cool idea, but what did they really do? Not much.
And you also have to look at what is your end game for the season? What is your arc? Because if your arc is just another Vanya destroys the world, your arc is, the escalating war between Russia and the United States. That's a little bit different. Even if Vanya causes it, there's more going on there, more there to explore. So you kind of have to figure out where you're going. But with either one of those scenarios, the Swedish guys don't make any sense. It feels like to me it was another reason to try and include the handler. The handler works fine when she's working her deals with Five, which he should be too smart to be dealing with anyway. But the handler still works fine as a wickedly delicious character. But the Swedish meatballs just do not work at all, even with her connection. Go ahead, Bracey. Let's hear your thoughts.
Yeah, Nemesis really summed up my feeling about the Swedes with the words, what did they accomplish? Nothing much, really, because that's my thought. Who was the guy who shot the handler? That's the only effect they've really had. They killed him in the opening episode when Five first popped into the past. Mm-hmm. Other than that, they've had no effect on the world. Everything they've attempted to do, they failed at. The only real effect they have is basically killing off peripheral characters, and we can see where they're going to go because the oldest brother has realized that the notes coming from the commission now are being sent by the handler because she likes to wear the scent of lavender, and he realizes they've been played. These guys would have been a lot more effective if they were more Terminator style, if they were just these three iconically, emotionless, nearly albino brothers who we don't get any backstory from. As a matter of fact, when each of them gets killed off, I think they would actually work better in this context if the Terminator style, once again, they don't even show any emotion. It's just that's just the job and we're doing it. Because if you're not going to have them really talk or really get into what they're about, let's just keep them really mysterious like that. Let's keep them this almost existential threat and make them a threat. Have them be the ones to hurt some people. It shouldn't necessarily have been, say, Hargreaves who hurt Diego. What if it was one of the Swedes? All of the characters, all of the main cast, all of the family should have been hurt by these guys at some point in the series. They should be a real threat because they're not a real threat. And if they're not a real threat, I have no reason to care about whether they pop up on screen or not.
Not only weren't they a real threat, they only had competency when the plot needed them to have competency. Better put, they were incompetent when the plot needed them to be incompetent. So
convenience once again.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I have a few things to add to that, but I think mostly you guys have really covered it. It's just that you're dealing with the fact that, these are minor nuisances at best. The only thing I can think that they did that had any impact was killing the dentist guy and then leaving him as a message, which honestly I didn't think made a whole lot of sense. But, at least they had that to their credit, I guess. Aside from that, they really haven't amounted to much at all. And then beyond that, what do they have to offer? I mean, they're not threatening in any way. They're only, there to kind of be obstacles before they're overcome. And then they gradually, get killed one by one. So they're not really that dangerous. Beyond that, I mean, I could at least be okay if they were interesting as characters. Like, mm-hmm. you can have ineffective villains that are at least fun to watch. If they have a personality that's interesting. I'm thinking of, particularly the Turks from Final Fantasy VII. There were this mini-boss squad that were working for the big masterminds, but, you're constantly beating them. But the thing is, they were interesting to hang out with. They all had well-developed personalities. You got to know them, and you felt like they grew. I can't say that for the Swedes. I mean, so, you know, it's like, why am I watching you? What do you have to offer if you can't even be entertaining? So, yeah, I have to say they're complete duds.
You know what I would do with these characters? I would go further than having them appear to be brothers. I would actually have them being the same guy at different points of his life. Ooh. And what the commission does is they just keep recruiting the same guy over and over again from different timelines. They always grab him as a young person and training him up to be this ultimate assassin. And so no matter how much you kill him or his supposed brothers, they keep popping back up, and that can be freaking people out.
That's an awesome idea.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know what occurred to me when listening to you guys talk is that the problem with this show is that whoever the showrunner and the writers are, they read the comics, obviously, and everything, and the only thing they took away from Umbrella Academy was that this is bizarre, and so they made the whole show the theater of the bizarre and the absurd. Yeah. You know, everything about this show, from what they've done with Klaus to the fact that the handler is basically Effie from the Hunger Games, you know, the way she dresses, yes. The Swedes, everything. Everything is because, let's be honest about it. The Umbrella Academy in the comics is screws with your mind. There's some weird stuff going on. But that's not all that it has to offer. But whoever read this and decided, oh, this would be a great show, decided that the selling point was the theater of the bizarre. And that is unfortunate. That is really what I have now realized listening to you guys talk today.
Yeah, and I would jump off a little bit on this and say there's a difference between being weird for the sake of being weird and being weird for the sake of making a point. I feel like the acid trip scene, that was weird with a point. I mean, she's trying to uncover her memories, okay? And they're doing this weird stuff, you know, to kind of simulate, like, LSD and things like that, which, you know, the government did use that in the 60s. So that had a point. But when you look at stuff like the Swedes and, you know, the goldfish-headed guy, it's like, okay, we're just weird to be weird, and we're being wacky. and does it accomplish anything? Well, no, not really. If you look at like weirdness like Grant Morrison does in his comics, particularly his Doom Patrol and things like that, yeah, he's bizarre, but you know he's a well-educated man and he's using the weird ideas to progress the story in some way, whether it's character or plot or symbolism or theme. And with this, it's just random.
All right. Okay. Now let me say this, and then we'll wrap up. Another thing that's happening on the show. Is it's really funny. I have to preface it with this. I'm not the kind of person that says something is all great because everybody else likes it last week, and then this week if everybody turns on it, and all of a sudden I'm saying it's garbage. I'm not that person. I'm pretty much going to be honest about how I feel, and I'm not. I'm just not the trendy person. You know, some people are just trendy. They just chase trends. That's not me. You know, I set my own stuff. So I say that to say this. This show is the result of the metahuman tropes flipping. It used to be metahumans were like the X-Men or like Martian Manhunter or like, you know, the victimized or, you know, feared and hated by a world they were trying to save, the X-Men's old line. And metahumans were the good guys, the underdogs. But with the boys at Umbrella Academy, that has flipped. And now the metas are dark and twisted and dour and cause more problems than they solve. The only exception on this show being Allison. Allison's the only character that you think of as a person who happens to everybody tend to see them through the lens of their powers. And that's how you know it's just a bunch of tropes. As opposed to characters. And so this is kind of like because the way life works over time is a pendulum just swings from one extreme to the other. And whenever one extreme is in vogue, people try to act like the other extreme is the worst thing that ever happened. Cut to 2 years later, the pendulum has swung the other way, and now all of a sudden, that thing that used to be the worst thing ever, people are marching it through the streets. See, I'm not that person. I can't take that. The Emperor ain't got no clothes on. He's butt naked. I don't care what year it is. And so, This and the Boys is the pendulum swinging the other way to where metahumans are the worst people. Silver Age in particular and Bronze Age, metahumans were about the best of humanity, which is why they don't know what to do with Superman and Captain America, because the trope has swung the other way.
Mm-hmm.
So that being the case, it's like we talked about before, I think it was Steve that said, with the Boys, everybody's evil. Everybody's got a secret. Everybody's going to betray what they believe for something else, to the point where we expect that now. That's why I've been so pleasantly surprised by Allison, because she was my least favorite character last year, and she has just completely done a 180 in the best kind of way this year, because she got fleshed out as a person, and it wasn't about her powers. And so I say that to say that, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens as things continue to unfold, because once again, Vanya is kind of the representation of the peak of that switch to where it used to be the metahuman saves the world. Now the metahuman destroys the world no matter what they do. So I'm hoping, you know, we got two more episodes this season. I'm just hoping there's a little maybe light at the end of this tunnel. I still don't think that's too much to ask, to where maybe somebody can see the good that can be done. Because even Hargreaves, the Professor X figure in this show, is the meanest, just ugliest, just smallest, just most petty, just hard to describe. He's not the dad you want. You don't want somebody like that adopting you, because he'll just make you miserable and crazy. So it'd be nice if at some point we get a little ray of hope from somebody that knows a little thing about writing optimistic characters or arcs. And on that note, we'll wrap it up for this episode this week. I want to thank my co-host. Thank you so much, Bracey.
My pleasure, sir.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Yeah, it's been glad being back with you guys, and hope that we can do it again soon.
And thank you so much, Nemesis.
No problem. Always great to talk about these shows. The only thing I have to say is I enjoy watching them. We enjoy watching them. It's just once we get in here and we get in this mode, we gotta be honest. We gotta tell you exactly what we see the problems are. So.
And we love dissecting everything and anything.
Yeah.
And we're objective about it.
Yep.
That's right. Or at least we admit our biases. I know I admit mine. So we want to thank you guys for listening in to our podcast. Don't forget to check out the other podcasts we have available on the United Capes Podcast Network. And we will see you next time on the next episode of Sloppy Spoilers. Spoilers.